Hi, and welcome to episode number 45 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. I am Francis Campoy, and I'm here with my colleague, Mark Mandel. Hello.
Hi, Francis. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Pretty excited about the interview with, again, one of my friends, Russell Smith from Brainforest QA. He's going to be telling us about what they do at Brainforest QA and how they use BigQuery to power all their analytics.
Basically analytics. No, it's actually really cool. They have, again, cross-cloud. It's an app running on Heroku, and they port a lot of their analytics over into BigQuery. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that is one of the ways people start using Google Cloud Platform very often is because, like, oh, BigQuery is cool. Yeah. So, yeah, very good. So, we're going to be talking about that. And then at the end, we're going to have a question of the week that comes. Actually, we have two questions of the week. One is, okay, so I want to do something after I receive an email. Not personally, but I want my program to react to emails, right? How do I do that? What is the best way? And then we also have a question about App Engine services, what we used to call App Engine modules, from one of our listeners, Stu, I'm going to say Schwartz, but it's probably Schwartz.
Schwartz.
I don't know. I'm going to make it German sound.
Okay.
Schwartz.
Sure. Schwartz.
But before that, we have the cool things of the week.
Yeah.
As usual. And the first one is the obvious one, which is Kubernetes 1.4.
Yeah. Super excited about Kubernetes 1.4. There's a bunch of new things in here. Just to pick out a couple of my favorites, both of which are in alpha, but I think they're still really exciting. The first is the kubeadm tool. This is really great. So if you don't run on GKE and you want to create your own Kubernetes clusters, we now have like a command line tool that you can like spin up master nodes and then join other nodes to join it, and makes it much easier. Still in alpha, so still worth, you know, like kind of playing with and providing feedback, but definitely in the right direction for Kubernetes, because setting up a cluster before was very, very difficult.
Yep. There was that document that I'm sure most of you have heard about, which was learning Kubernetes the hard way.
Yeah, it was one of Kelsey Hightower's GitHubs.
Yeah, which is a very good document, but it was also a very good friction log. And so it was like, this is really hard. So yeah, the new version is making all of those things easier, which is very nice to see.
Yeah, and also they're going to have scheduled jobs, which makes me very happy. So if you want something to happen on a time-based interval,
yep,
that's in alpha now as well. Been waiting for that for ages.
Yeah, it is. It is actually very simple, but yeah, like I just assume it was always there personally. So it is very nice to see that it's finally there. So yeah, if you want to run a, I was gonna say a cron job, but which is basically what it is. If you want to run a job like every day at 8 a.m., now you can.
Well, looking at the syntax, actually, it uses cron tab syntax.
Yeah. So it's basically cron job.
It's basically cron job. It's pretty cool. The other thing for cool thing of the week, I just wanted to make like a call out to some people in our community and some of the stuff they've been writing. I'm going to mess this up. Fernando Damian Lopez wrote a really nice little concise blog post about just starting up a Compute Engine VM from App Engine.
Nice.
Which I think is a very popular sort of modulus operandi for a lot of people. It's a very common pattern.
I'm assuming he's using the REST API.
He's got the source code in Python there, how to configure the right permissions on how to do stuff. And it's just really clean, concise, and like, yeah, if you wanted to do it from like a cron job, for example, or something like that, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, we have a link to that on the show notes. And there's actually a fourth cool thing of the week, which is a cool thing of the day, which is Google's 18th anniversary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought about that.
That's cool.
Happy birthday, Google.
Happy birthday.
There you go. So I think it's time to go talk to our friend Russell.
Let's do that then.
So I'm very happy to welcome Russell Smith to the podcast. Hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
Very happy, very excited about all the questions we're going to be asking you today, especially about the end, about BigQuery. He just shared a number of rows with me, and I think it's pretty amazing. So, but before we get into the details of data and stuff like that, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what do you do?
Cool. So, yeah, I'm Russell, CTO and co-founder of Rainforest QA. Basically, CTO means a lot of different things to different people, but for me, I run the technical side of Rainforest. So I'm responsible for the direction and basically that we're successful technically. So, been going about 4 or 5 years now. So 2012, late 2011, 2012 kind of thing. Moved over from the UK with Fred, my co-founder, the CEO. Got into YC and started working on Rainforest shortly after that. So, yeah, that's a brief history of Russ.
Cool. Well, that sounds really interesting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Rainforest QA, what's like the general gist? What is that? What does the company do?
Cool. So Rainforest is QA as a service. So we give you a web interface and APIs and command line tools in order to do your QA. So you can go in, enter tests in plain English. So whether you're a developer or a PM, you can write basically regression tests for your web app. Then you can trigger them either using the interface or using the API or put it into your CI build, which is one of the most common ways of doing it. So we enable you to do human-powered QA super, super fast in a normal continuous integration build. So a lot of our customers are using it to speed up their release process by doing their QA in stuff like CircleCI or Jenkins, which is pretty cool. The other thing is, because it's in plain English, it's enabling other people on the team to write more maintainable tests than would be with something like general automation tools, if you guys have ever used them, generally pretty brittle. Writing stuff in plain English, whilst it has its nuances, generally leads to a test that is more reliable once you've got it nailed down.
So I could write like a script where I could be like, you know, go get a product that's green and then, you know, put it in your shopping cart and then go through to checkout. And then someone would actually go ahead and do that.
Yeah. The classic one would be to like ask them to sign up and ask them to check if the email was received or if they got a text message to a number and all those kind of extra tooling around email checking, third party auth, getting phone numbers and stuff is all handled by us and all automatic and pretty awesome.
Cool. So just to have an idea, how does it actually work? Like if I do this thing, I was like, I have my version,
classic
right?
Question.
Like how does it, like no, I have my sure. version and I'm like, oh yeah, I want to run some tests. So I cool. give you my script, which is like, for instance, I don't know, log into gcpodcast.com and click on download on episode 45,
that
for
would
instance.
Be a great test.
Yeah.
You know, so, okay. Basically, we store all the stuff for you, all your tests for you, or you can store them in plain text in your repo and then just upload them to us automatically. Once you actually hit our API and say, hey, Rainforest, run all these tests, we do a couple of things. One, we copy all those tests and version them so that if you ever change your test in the future, we know which ones we ran. Mm-hmm. But then the next thing is we start farming it out to the workers we've got online. So normally we have a few thousand workers, up to like 5,000 workers online at any one time. And we were talking about this earlier, but we basically give out the work in kind of a special way. So we use Elixir Project. This is one of our first Elixir production apps that connects to a Chrome extension that the testers download. So we know which testers are online when and when they want to work. So much like, say, Uber, when you want to do rides as an Uber driver, you just open up the app and say, hey, I want to do rides. For our testers, they just open up their browser and then they just click on the icon for Rainforest and it just turns it on. And we know that they want work. And then we can just pipe the work to them. So we can say, hey, this person's most qualified for the job that you've just asked for. We're going to give that to you. So we can do that very, very quickly. So I guess stepping back a bit, the traditional way of doing this with a crowdsource-based system, so something like MTurk or Crowdflower would be you do the call to Rainforest. Rainforest then does a call to Crowdflower, say, and says, hey, list a job on the service. And then we list a job there. Then the worker goes to the page when they feel like it, refreshes the page, sees like a Craigslist-style listing of things to do, clicks on one, maybe decides to do it, and then like does it. So that process took, I don't know, 3 to 7 minutes to do maybe traditionally, and then relied on workers actually refreshing. So we ended up building notification services on top of that. But then we realized the easier way to do it is just to make them install a Chrome extension or have them install a Chrome extension. So this is much more fluid way. So after pressing the button or using the API or doing it in a build, it's generally a few seconds before we get the first workers doing your work, which is pretty crazy when you realize how many humans that is.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing.
You know, we accidentally DDoS, not DDoS, but we take people down.
Oh, really?
So
you're testing for functionality, but it's like, oh, yeah, it doesn't scale.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the things we've got to ship this quarter is something to allow us to limit the parallelism. Because I guess, unlike, say, if you're doing testing traditionally with Selenium style stuff, a lot of the cloud hosted providers for that will, maybe you'll get 64 parallel things at once. We can do a couple of thousand things in parallel. So that tends to put a large amount of load on your system if you're not used to it.
Nice. So from an architectural point of view,
sure.
How does Rainforest QA distribute all of these flows? Like, are these applications that you're testing running on the customer side and you manage the...
Yeah, generally, well, in fact, 100% of cases, the application is running, the customer runs it. And the main reason why is it's, well, you guys are developers, it's like so many different ways of running something and many different ways of having dependencies and getting in the right state. It's just totally non-trivial to do right, to run somebody else's app. So, we let you run that. And generally people deploy to a staging or a QA environment and then point Rainforest at that. Works pretty well. If you're on Heroku, you can actually use, this feature called, review apps, which is pretty badass. If you do a pull request, it'll start an app with that code and then you can point Rainforest at that as well. I know you were talking about doing that for Google, right? For your App Engine stuff.
Yeah, trying to implement something like that. It is fun. And I don't think it is that hard. So maybe we'll be able to share some news.
Well, you could use an App Engine version manually.
Yeah, you can. So yeah, but what I'm trying to do is not do that automatically.
You could be fun. Automate that.
Yeah. So that is about all the web integration tests, right? Sure. Like all of that is about the web. What about mobile? Mobile first? So.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. We launched, I guess we've been running mobile for, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 months now for a few customers, maybe 10 customers. And then last week we launched a self-serve version of this that anyone can sign up to today, where you prepay for credits rather than enter into a contract with us. So yeah, we're powered by Amazon's device farm. I see you guys cringing. You guys didn't do iOS fast enough on your Firebase stuff, so we had to go with them. But they're awesome. So they give us real devices, like direct. Well, I say direct. So they give us real devices, but the way they're designed was for running automated tests. So because we're powered by humans, we actually need to like give the device to them, as in present it to the tester. And it wasn't really set up for that. So we had to build some pretty cool tech to allow us to basically transport the device into the person's browser. So short version is we wrote a VNC server and an SSH server and some reverse tunneling magic that goes into the app. So we can inject it into your app. And then when your app starts on there, we can reverse tunnel back into it and take control of the phone, which is kind of awesome because it turns out it actually works, even though it sounds totally crazy. But it just means we can run like 100, 200 devices at once and give them out to testers instantly. So super low friction for you as a end user, as a customer. Also, you again, writing tests in plain English, so like very low brittleness of your tests and also super easy to get started.
So with all of these testers and all the tests and devices that you can be running at the same time, I'm imagining that you are generating a pretty decent amount of data. How do you handle that? Like, do you create a, like, do I get an email saying passed?
Or yeah, well, actually, kind of. So at a high level, yeah, you'll get, there's a bunch of ways of notifying you, but one of the classic ones is email. So you will get an email that just says passed, but then it lists all the tests that is passed. The interesting one is when you get failures, like we'll send you the failure and what browser or device it failed on. And then if you click on the link, you can go down into like seeing what the tester did, whether that's through screenshots or device logs for iOS stuff. Or for web stuff, we'll give you HA format, which is, I guess you guys are Google people. So it's a format, I think, invented here that's Chrome exports from the network debug panel. So anyway, we'll give you that same format, which means you can use some of the same tools to like introspect it and figure out what's going on. But so you can get the actual logs because we man in the middle our own machines to be able to track all the requests that go through, all the requests that the testers do. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. But
as for where we store that data, it's a bunch of it is in Postgres. Some of it now is going into a Google BigQuery. And then a bunch of it is stored on S3. So the staticky stuff that doesn't change is stored on S3.
So you said some of it goes to BigQuery. Now, you were sharing a very large number with us earlier. Yeah. Is that really just some of the data?
Yeah, that's just some of the data. So short version, we use Heroku like a lot. Almost all of our infrastructure is on Heroku, apart from the machines that provide virtual machines to testers. They're in a different place. But Heroku has this like super little known feature called log drains. And log drains let you pipe log output from your app and all the like processes of the app to anywhere you want. So like traditionally that only supported syslog, but they like added an undocumented, or I think at the time undocumented, feature where you could do HTTP based transport. So I spoke with you guys like maybe a year or two ago.
Yeah.
And figured out, hey, I'm just going to write a Go program that uses the streaming API for BigQuery and just takes in all the logs from our entire infrastructure and puts them into BigQuery. So now the cool thing is we're having a bunch of problems with our logging provider, who I'm guessing I should probably not name because I don't want any politics here. But we were looking for a good log provider, one that was fast and searchable and didn't have bad retention and didn't cost us an absolute fortune a year. And then realized, like, actually, there aren't any. We've since found logdna.com, which I highly recommend those guys. They're like cheap. They do like a good job. They're not super loads of bells and whistles, but that's the trade-off with them. They just do what you need, which is search. But anyway, we still use BigQuery for this. So Go program, streaming API, takes in all the logs from our whole infrastructure and just puts it straight into a table. It also does some extra nice stuff for parsing out the different fields and putting them into the right columns. But yeah, we've got about 25 billion log lines in BigQuery now. So it's kind of cool.
That's really cool. Do you know like how much do you tend to ingest? Can you share that with us? Like over a certain time period?
It's normally a floor of like 1,000 rows a second kind of thing. And then it goes up depending on traffic. So that's normally our baseline for Rainforest. Maybe it's a bit lower at the weekend, but during the week it's about that. So so it's not super high log-wise, I guess. It spikes though.
Yeah, I mean, 1,000 requests per second is pretty decent, to be honest.
Oh, so Tripoli, the program, A, I've been meaning to open source forever, so I should probably actually do it. But B, it runs on Heroku, so it's like self. It's kind of weird. Heroku logs going to Heroku, then going to you guys. So, yeah, super cool.
And that's cool. So once the data's in BigQuery, what are you actually doing with it there?
Yeah, good question. So we have a bunch of standard queries that we run to find some issues. So we either run them directly in your dashboard or we use something called Redash, which I think you actually recommended to me like a while ago. But Redash, for those of you that don't know, is kind of an open source dashboarding system. But it lets you run queries on schedules and it connects to like Postgres, Mongo, MySQL, but also BigQuery and Redshift and like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's super cool for that. So we use that. So we have a bunch of queries that run regularly to find certain things that we're looking for or do stats. And super awesome because it's cheap to run on you guys and it's also fast.
So having that amount of rows on BigQuery, I'm wondering, how do you manage? Do you actually have a bunch of different tables? It's just one humongous table with billions of rows.
Lol. This is the noob mistake, which I need to fix, which I was reading the docs about recently. But when I first started, I didn't realize that we should do named date version tables. Turns out, like at least in the past, that was impossible to fix without just making a new set of tables, which I didn't really want to do. So I think I read the docs correctly saying that I can actually do that now without taking it offline, which looks kind of cool. So anyway, I haven't got around to it because the cost is actually low enough that I don't care yet.
That is nice.
Even though, like, I'm kind of attracted by the fact that if the data is still for a month or something, it's like half the cost. Is that correct? There's some discount if it's the data doesn't get added to after a period of time. Anyway, most of our data is...
We should check that out. I'm actually not sure.
No, I was digging around the BigQuery docs, so I'm pretty sure that's correct. But Google it yourself.
Oh, yeah. So if a table is not edited for 90 consecutive days, the price of storage for that table automatically drops by 50% to 0.01 per gigabyte per month.
Which is totally insane.
1 cent per gigabyte per month.
Oh, wow.
It's insane. And it's also awesome.
That is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So
we learned BigQuery from him. That is.
Yeah, that's why we do this podcast.
We're not very good at this.
So I need to switch to partition tables so that we can take advantage of
that. Yeah, that way.
No, we have one table with nearly 25 billion rows in. So.
Yeah.
And it's working.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Out of curiosity, like, what? How long does it take to execute the most complex query you have?
So normally we don't really run queries over the full data set unless there's some security thing that we're trying to investigate.
That is probably a good idea.
And there's this awesome thing in BigQuery where you can scope by, not by data in the table, but by when that data was inserted.
Okay.
So almost all our queries are, I can't remember what it's called, but anyway, almost all our queries are done by that. So they're normally, depending on what you're doing, they're normally either a day or a week's worth of stuff.
Okay.
That which makes I sense. Think is actually the max for that. But, only on rare circumstances do we query all of the data ever, but it's normally if we have something that somebody's like, oh, this thing happened like 2 months ago. Can you help us? I'm like, yeah, maybe we can, turns out. But so, yeah, we don't normally query the whole data set. But so things are pretty quick, like normally sub a minute. I mean, we queried earlier to find out how many rows were in the table today. And that was the longest query I've ever seen, which was just over a minute. And that's because it counted every single thing ever, which is kind of still really cool. 68 seconds.
68 seconds to
count 25 billion rows.
25 billion rows.
That's pretty cool.
That is not bad.
I can live with that.
So you were talking about your visualizations and you were saying you're using it to like find certain issues and things. Can you talk a little bit more like what sort of issues that you're looking for or how are you using that
in the visualizations?
Yeah.
So I don't know, we're looking at trends. So we're also using another awesome product to do this, which seems to actually be the better way of doing it. Short version, we're looking at trends in like memory usage or like load. Can we spot any trends that are outliers and then dig into why this happened? So we're actually using a service called honeycomb.io, which also I think is in beta, but can super recommend those guys. Short version, we're trying to find like, hey, this bunch of requests was slow. Like, why was that? And then, for instance, we were investigating the other day and found one of our dynos, which I guess Heroku parlance for like a machine running a process, was using way more swap than all the other machines for no apparent reason. So like digging into that, well, even finding that was only possible using BigQuery and Honeycomb.
So most of your data really is about like machine analytics and seeing what your actual things are doing.
Yeah, we haven't moved to... And there's another thing that we're working on, which is to use to move some of our data or a lot of our most important tables from Postgres into BigQuery. And the main reason we want to do that is for doing like analytics. So like finding out, turns out we have too much data to be able to query the entire thing at a reasonable speed on Postgres. So we've got, I don't know, coming up to 300 or 400 gigs of data, which actually doesn't seem like that much, but turns out is enough. It's expensive to run at a fast speed when we're doing stupid queries. anyway, short version, we're working on a way of exporting that data direct into BigQuery, which will mean that we can do the more insane queries faster, which is going to be cool. Maybe we'll open source that as well.
Yeah, you should.
Should open source the first one as well.
Yeah, and write a blog post, you said.
Good point.
So Now that you've been using BigQuery for a while, and I'm, as you were saying, you had some noob mistakes, like having just one huge table for everything.
Yeah.
Do you have any other piece of advice for people that are starting to migrate? They have like a huge database relational and they're like, oh, should I move to BigQuery?
Sure. Yeah, basically, like, the biggest limitation when I started doing it was I did read the docs, but I just didn't bother doing a bunch of stuff because I wanted to get started. But, like, the biggest thing I would say now is make sure you read the docs properly and probably go with the standard SQL stuff, which seems to be the new version. I'm still on the older version. Standard SQL seems super awesome because it removes one of the major limitations of BigQuery, which is updating stuff, which, like, now you can treat it almost like a proper database.
Yeah, that is proper, actually.
I don't mean that meanly, by the way.
Like, no,
it's not like just depend only now. You can actually update things.
For quite a long time, yeah, BigQuery was only append only. You could, which, I mean, totally makes sense if you're talking about something to analyze logs.
Totally makes sense.
Modifying
perfect
logs
use case for us, but horrible use case for the analytics stuff for us. Because we need to just drop it every time we want to update it again, which I guess is also possible. I would say definitely look at the streaming API. It's pretty awesome. It also means stuff's really fast. There's a really good Go library for it that I found, which I will get put in the podcast notes.
Yeah, we'll put it on the show notes.
Yeah. And then I guess the only other thing, what do you want to do to wrap up? Like, the only other thing I was going to say was I'm speaking at reInvent about MTurk. So if anyone wants to come say hi, do that. I'll also be at the CTO Summit in November. So if anyone wants to say hi there, do it.
Cool. Go find him and ask him about BigQuery.
or Turk or any crowdsourcing stuff. So
cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with us. That's a very interesting interview. I will have a bunch of links to all the different projects that you've mentioned. And hopefully we also have links to the open source versions of your software soon.
I just hired a VPN, so I should actually have some time to do this kind of stuff now.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. It was a pleasure and a joy to have Russell Smith on with us today. I definitely appreciate hearing about people building interesting things, especially, I think, across cloud. I think that's really interesting to see how people are doing that sort of stuff. It was really good in the amount of data he's processing. It's decent amount.
It is. Yeah. When he was walking away, we had a quick chat. And one of the things that I was saying was like, oh, so like you have like 25 billion rows. Are they like very short rows? It's like, oh, no, like they have like tens or more fields. It's like, oh, wow. OK. And some of the fields have JSON inside. So it's like decent amount of data. Too. I was like, wow. Yeah. Very cool. So looking forward to all the open sourcing of those tools. I'm very excited about them, especially because they're raining go.
Yes. Very good. That makes you very happy. All right, cool. So let's get into our questions of the week.
Yeah.
You raised the first one, which I think is an interesting one and got me very excited, which is how to react to email from Google Cloud. So say I don't know. This is always a fun one. I'm going to get sent an email by some third party, Mayfree, for example, and I want to be able to automatically do something about it once I receive it. How can I find out when like that email comes to me so I can parse its data and do stuff like that?
So this actually comes from a customer that asked me this question, and it was pretty fun because they were like, you know, what they need to do something very complex on Compute Engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that very complex job needs to be done every single time that someone could update a database that it was publicly available, built by NASA, actually.
Okay.
The impressive thing is that the way they could notify people about there's new data in the database is by sending emails.
Of course.
So, yeah. So you had someone that was receiving that email that then could go and run a script that could start everything, right? And I was like, I'm pretty sure there's a better way to do this.
Yep.
And there's many ways of doing it. One of them could be run your own web server, run your own mail server.
Let's not do that. That doesn't sound like fun.
That is definitely not fun. Then another thing you could do is basically use IMAP to connect from your script that runs regularly, like for instance using cron, and like every hour checks if there's new email. If there's new email, to start doing stuff. But then the problem is that how often do you check?
You're basically polling.
Yeah, so you're polling all the time, so it's kind of not perfect. And there's actually a very, very easy solution, which is just using App Engine. So
App Engine can receive email?
Yeah. So you actually get the same way you get a URL to host your web server, which is like your appid.appspot.com. You also get an email, which is whatever you want, at your appid.appspotmail.com. So if you send an email to that address, what will happen is that the email will be sent as a post HTTP request to your application. So now if your instance is not running, like your application is not running because you don't have any traffic, which probably normal if you're only receiving mail once a day, what will happen is that when you receive that request, your new instance will start and you will treat that and then you do whatever you want. And one of the things that you can, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, was that you can start a new Compute Engine instance and then from there you do whatever you need.
I'm just actually genuinely blown away that App Engine can receive email. Like, I didn't realize it could do this, and it's so cool.
The best part is that it has been there for, like, ever. It is really not new. It is, very simple. And if you don't know what it's there, yeah, it is good.
My mind is literally blown. It is literally blown.
Yeah, it is. It is a pretty fun thing to do. And talk about App Engine, we also have a second question of the week coming from our friend Stu Schwartz, tell us how you pronounce it. So it's about App Engine services, which for people who have been using App Engine for a while, you might have known as App Engine modules. And he's asking, okay, so when should I use App Engine versus GKE? Is this a scale issue, an approach issue, implementation issue? And then the second question, which is more related to App Engine services, is should I have a bunch of services? Should I have a bunch of projects and one service per project? And the answer to the second part of the question is, well, have as many services as you need. Microservices are awesome.
And when you say services, we're talking about modules.
Modules, yeah. So you can have basically a different app. It's basically a different App Engine application, but they share the same resources, right? So if you want to make them communicate through like
REST,
you can, but also you can use task queues and all of these things. And it's very easy to communicate because they're all in the same project. When to use more than one project? Normally, I could reserve that to different environments. So if you have like prod, QA, stuff like that, then those are good because that way you're not sharing the data store, which is probably a good idea. If you like, you should not give access to the prod data just to do tests, right? So it is a good place to separate, but you should have all your production services in one single project. Much easier to handle. And then about the question, when to use App Engine versus GKE, maybe you can give us a little bit of background on that.
Yeah, so this is an interesting question. I'll harken back for a more detailed response to our episode number 2, Compute as a Continuum, where we go into much nuanced detail about it. But I feel like it's really more a question of how much flexibility and control do you want. App Engine Standard and App Engine Flexible give you slightly different versions of that. Whereas, you know, App Engine Standard, Platform as a Service, we dictate, you know, a lot of things about how you do stuff. But that gives you great scale, which is really powerful. Flex, we give you a few more configuration options, a few more like bits and pieces, so you can run pretty much anything you want it. But now you can't scale to zero. We don't spin up quite as fast. So there's the trade-off. Yeah. But if you want still the sort of capability such that things stay up, if they fall over, they come back. You still want to be able to deploy with a rolling update, things like that. GKE is a great place for that, but you now have even more tweaks and knobs that you can pull, right? Yeah. So you'll have a cluster of machines in that case. You pay for that cluster of machines. You can auto-scale it to a degree. But then you can do things like resource management or have jobs or now schedule jobs as well once that comes out of alpha. But you have way more control and you can start to say, you know, maybe I want to have stuff with a whole bunch of memory in it, which is way more than I'd be able to get on App Engine or something like that. Persistent volume mounts, their state that I want to be able to put in places, things that you can't necessarily do as easy on App Engine. So it's probably really down to like what sort of application you're building and then what sort of capabilities you really want to be able to have at hand.
Yeah, my rule of thumb is if it can run an App Engine, it will run an App Engine, because that way I can forget about like all the DevOps, and I just deploy it and I know it will be running there forever.
Yep.
And that makes me happy. But if it's something that I'm going to need to be like, oh no, like I have all of these services and there's dependencies across them and I want them to be able to scale them independently and update them independently and all that stuff, then GKE is probably the best place. Yeah.
Seems pretty reasonable.
Cool. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing next week?
So I've got a lot of travel. I say that with some sadness during October, but I'm doing some fun events, so that's pretty cool. So I will be at Siege in Atlanta on the 8th of October. That's going to be a fun gaming conference. After that, I will be at Connect Tech on the 20th. I'll be back in Atlanta again on the 20th. That's a general web dev conference. And then I'll be at Gamercon, another game conference on the 27th. So I have a fair bit of travel in October.
Nice.
And yourself, where are you doing?
So next week, I will be in New York. And I'm going to be running a workshop. And you're all invited. It's going to be on Wednesday 5th. Yeah, Wednesday 5th, October 5th. So next Wednesday. Yep. And yeah, it's about how to build highly scalable web applications with Go on App Engine.
Cool.
And it's going to be hosted by Women Who Go in New York.
Nice.
Everyone is welcome. So we'll have a link on the show notes to that. And then I'm also very excited about something else, which is not traveling, but kind of. I'm going to be doing a remote meetup. So yeah, and that will be on Monday after that, so on October 10th, and it's going to be kind of the same. So it's a mini workshop. It's how to build a web application. It says with Francesc. It will be with Go, actually. But but yeah, basically it's going to be online, and you can ask all the questions that you want. So if you will be in New York next week, you're all invited to come to that workshop. But if not, the Monday after that, there will be something online and you can be there whatever in the world you are. And also it will be recorded so you can watch it later if you want to.
That's cool. I should make mention that if you are at any of the events that we're going to be at, we do have new GCP podcast stickers.
We have stickers and they're awesome. Yeah.
And they're awesome. So if you happen to be where we are and you want to come up and say hi and get a sticker, please do.
Yeah, yeah. And we also have t-shirts. We don't travel around with t-shirts all the time.
No. Sometimes I do.
Yeah, but stickers, yeah.
Stickers are way easier to carry.
Come find us and get stickers.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much, Francesc, for joining me yet again.
Thank you, Mark. And talk to you next week.
See you next week.
See ya.